Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Greetings, podcastonauts, and welcome to the IDTNT podcast number 977. I hope you're getting ready for a wonderful holiday. If you celebrate Christmas, great. If you don't, fine. If you celebrate Festivus, if you just like to go out and look at a tree, if you say, ah, screw all of it, I don't need any of it, whatever it is this time of year, this period of hopefully rebirth, regrowth, assessment, plans for the next year that you'll do some of, who knows. Even if it's nothing for you, I hope you enjoy this time of year as we start inching closer to the Julian calendar that tells us that time is upon us to shift. If you have an event that you want to have mentioned on the top of the podcast, events@id10t.com is the email address for that. And I'll say your thing that you made, like Al Casper, who writes, my two best friends and I did a thing. We took our undying love of all things retro gaming and put our never-ending gushing for all things classic into a bi-weekly podcast. We are the Retro Rents, dads who sacrifice sleep to keep playing the games we grew up with and share those games with our children. We're also starting to schedule interviews with game developers of legend to talk about what inspired to make the games we still can't stop talking about. You can find us on all the usual podcast avenues. Just look for the Retro Rents and join in on the fun. We are highly interactive with our audience, who are just as much a part of our show as the hosts. Well done, Al Casper. Although it's spelled K-A-S-P-A-R, so maybe it's Al Caspar. It just sounds like an alien who's trying to sound like an earthling. I am Al Caspar, says. Al Caspar says it is time to rejuvenate my cells with a nourishing meal. Thank you, Al Caspar. Ryan writes, I'm launching a blog to give guidance in jewelry buying. I have over 15 years experience in the jewelry industry, retail, custom, and wholesale, and have walked hundreds of people through the jewelry buying process. In my experience, jewelry isn't really on the radar of our geek community until they feel they have to buy something and people are going in blind. I want to present the buying process in a relatable, entertaining, and respectful way with nerdy pop culture references mixed in. The name of the site is geeksandgold.com. This is the time of year people make big purchases, and this will be the unbiased, open, and honest place for the jewelry beginners to go. Well done, Ryan. Also, ID10T has its own Instagram account, which I post on when I get to it. So just follow it and just know that you will not be inundated with stuff because I've been a little lazy about it, TBH. But I'm working on it. And then the new ID10T site will hopefully be up soon. And again, send your thing events@id10t.com. This episode is Bob Roth, who is the head of the David Lynch Foundation. You've probably been hearing me talk about TM, Transcendental Meditation, for the past handful of time. And it's whatever your preconceived notions are about it, it's not some goofy culty thing. It's really just about clearing your mind. And so many people I know are doing it to just keep their thoughts clear, to keep their heads clear, to quiet the clutter in their mind. And I've absolutely been loving it. I've been doing it since maybe February of this year is when I started. I went to the David Lynch Foundation and met with an amazing woman named Lynn Kaplan who taught me how to do it. You should definitely, if it's something that you're interested in or even just are curious about, then go online, look up whatever you can, find out at davidlynchfoundation.org and get started. Just explore it. What's it going to hurt? Especially as we're heading into the new year. Maybe you want to learn how to be calmer or less reactive or just more mindful or whatever it is. But it's incredibly easy to do and feels incredibly personal. And this guest, Bob Roth, wrote the book Strength in Stillness, which is kind of one of the go-to books for understanding transcendental meditation from beginner level and getting interested. He's such a sweet man with such a wonderful presence. And I was in New York at the beginning of November and just threw a Hail Mary pass to Lynn Kaplan. I said, hey, I'm going to be in New York. Do you think Bob would want to do the podcast? And the next day she wrote back and said, he's in. So I went to his office. He was beyond awesome. Just a lovely, lovely guy with so much great information, so thoughtful. He really kind of almost interviews me because he's such a student of humanity and he seems to love people. He really kind of wanted to know what some of my journey was. So there's a little bit of me kind of talking about my experience, but he gets a lot of great information and stories and metaphors, and he's just a wonderful, wonderful guy. So pick up his book, Strength and Stillness, if it's something that you're into. And then, DavidLynchFoundation.org. And then at the end of this did not make it into the podcast, but I almost like cried when this happened. And if you've been studying TM or if you start studying TM, maybe you'll understand why this was meaningful. But we wrapped up. I put all the podcast equipment away. The podcast recording equipment, it was okay. I didn't necessarily have the best setup because it was very, very mobile. But I think it still sounds okay. So at the end, I pack everything up. And he says, before you go, do you want to do a meditation? I was like, oh, what? Me? You and me? Of course. So he says, I'll tell you what. I got to run out to a meeting, but I'm going to get you started. I'm going to give you some instruction. And I mean, this guy's been instructing people since the 1960s. I mean, this was legendary to have this experience. So, he gives me a blanket. He had a blanket in his office and a pillow. And he says, like, lean your head back on this nice fuzzy blanket, lean back in the chair. He gave me some wonderful, wonderful advice to sort of talk me through the beginning of it, some insight, some wonderful instruction. And then just as I started to drift off, it started raining up against the glass windows of the building in his office in Midtown. And it was just one of the most magical experiences. And I completely just disappeared for 20 minutes. And the next thing I knew, he came in and he started talking me out of it, pulling me out of it. And it was just such a magical, wonderful, special thing that is just tucked away in the locker of my heart as one of my favorite things that I've ever gotten to be a part of. So thank you so much to Bob Roth and to Lynn Kaplan and the David Lynch Foundation. And I hope that if you hear this, you are inspired to look into it just to make you a better and more effective you and be more true to what you deserve, which is to be kind to yourself and to have positive experiences and to be the best version of you. So here is the ID10T podcast number 977 with Bob Roth.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
You know, this isn't the best set of predictions.
Something to put that on, or
I'll just put that on the bottom. you could just knock it
knock
down.
Knock it off. Sorry, I'm sorry.
It's not what I would have expected.
Yeah, that's not what I meant.
Wow, Bob. Yeah. It's not.
Yeah. Nice guy,
really violent.
Vicious.
Right off
vicious,
the bat. Like,
vicious.
Broke the equipment.
Who yeah. knew?
No idea.
The guy's like a fraud.
You know, it's interesting to me to see you in person with your voice coming out of your body, because I've heard your voice. A lot, like, as I listen to the audiobook, because I'm in L.A. and I spend a lot of time in traffic. But then just hearing
Did you fall asleep from the audiobook?
I did not fall asleep in traffic.
I was very concerned. So when I give introductory talks, like, at 8 o'clock at night, it was like...
Yeah, introductory at 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
It's really just sort of depends.
Counterindicated.
Well, yeah, but aren't the people that you're talking to, like, just hyper-stressed?
Yeah, but then they go...
Then they relax.
So I try talking louder because I got to get some more.
They're going to wake up. Yeah. Now we're going to close our eyes.
So tell me about. I could interview you.
Go ahead. Yeah, that's fine. That's just a conversation.
How did you hear about TM?
So I've been hearing about it.
Tell me about your background.
Well, I'll tell you. My family moved a lot, and I didn't have a lot of friends. Yeah. No, my dad was a professional bowler.
God, that's a whole podcast right there.
I mean, I've talked about it endlessly, and I'm sure people who listen to this podcast have heard more about bowling than they ever want to hear in their entire life.
Are you a bowler?
Well, I'm not going to brag, but yes.
Have you thrown 300 games?
No, I haven't done that.
Did your dad?
My dad had the record for 300 games. He was in the Guinness Book for ages.
Your last name is?
Hardwick.
Because I used to watch bowling on Saturday afternoon.
My dad was on Saturdays.
Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
I thought it was just me watching.
Billy Hardwick, my dad, was
That's
a professional
fantastic.
Bowler, yeah. So we moved a lot and, you know, just a pretty probably standard, stand-up comedian, stressy, anxious. And I have a lot of friends who are... So I think the comedians of the 80s and before were mostly on drugs, except for Jerry Seinfeld. And then and the comedians now are mostly sober and into meditation. And
look at them all.
Yeah.
I mean, the list of people that I've taught, and there's many others.
Yeah, we like
Why
it.
Why is that?
Because we have very active internal monologues. And the internal monologues, first of all, you don't realize you can control or ignore it because it's the inside of your head talking. And number two, it usually says bad things to you. You know, it just puts you down or tells you why you're self-deprecating, tells you why you're a piece of crap. And so I think a lot of performers and comedians are finding TM because they just want ways to quiet that voice without taking drugs or drinking or sex addiction or whatever it is that they're trying to distract. You know, now social media, you know, whatever it is to try to shut that voice off. So I think that's probably why. But I had a couple of friends who... I just asked, like, sober friends. I've been sober 15 years. I have other friends who are sober.
Okay,
I asked
that's
them.
That's great.
Yeah, and then my friend Joe Manganiello was the guy that pulled all the boulders off the mountain for me. He was like the last of like five people.
Wow.
And he goes, "Yeah, I've been doing TM. You know, it's like I just shut my eyes and I go, okay, I got to do this." So I went to your. Lynn Kaplan.
How long ago was that?
Probably about 8 months ago now, and instantly fell in love with it.
Had you ever tried meditating before?
No, and in your book, I had a lot of the preconceived notions that most people probably have, which is it's hard to understand what it means to not do anything. That I thought meditation was like, oh, you have to, just like you're going to sit there and clench your fist and you got to meditate so hard. What if I'm not doing it right? And it's like, oh, no, this is literally designed.
Isn't it great how easy it is?
Yes.
That's the thing that people come into, because I've been teaching this forever, and they have all these preconceptions of what meditation is or should be or, is that going?
Yeah, it's going.
Should be or whatever. And then they open their eyes after the first thing. Really?
Yeah, I know. But I also... I also blame the word transcendental meditation a little bit.
Tell me why.
Because I think to people who have no idea what it is, it sounds hippy dippy. It sounds like 60s and you're in row. You know, it's
no, and
like
also
we're in
trance.
A cult.
There's like trance.
Yeah.
Whereas the root of it is transcendent.
Right.
People love a transcendent experience.
Of course they do.
You have it when you hold a newborn child in your arms. In sports, there's that zone. Listening to music, probably the flow when you're really on, when you're comedy.
Yes.
You ever had that before?
Yes.
Yeah. It's sort of unfortunate because people go, I thought so. Well, meditation is weird, but transcendental meditation is like even weirder.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, if it were called like zone breathing or something, people would go, oh, I got to do that because it's, you know, sounds like something you'd see on an infomercial.
But it's starting to change, I have to say.
Absolutely.
Because people will call up and I say, you know, I've tried mindfulness, I've tried these different things, but I want that one.
And also, you know, when you explain to people who have no idea what it is, they're like, oh, well, is it like a cult? And you're like, no, it's not at all. It's not religious. It's not anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really just, you know, quieting your mind. And the way that I've been explaining it to people is, you know, most of your day, what you do to your brain is like if you went into a gym and just did curls for like 12 hours. and you wouldn't be able to lift your arms, but instead of resting, you just kept curling. Yeah. And it's like, it's just the same thing. You have to take breaks build muscle.
That's fabulous.
And so that's sort of the same.
Yeah, you have to take breaks to build muscle.
That's exactly right.
And they actually find even sleep, what happens during sleep is that if you're trying to memorize something, that it actually, what you're trying to memorize, if you get a good night's sleep, it metabolizes. You actually integrate it into your memory with rest. And so TM just gives the body deeper state of rest.
Yeah, and with you, there's so many things that I, you know, because you're the Sirius show, which is so perfectly named, the Success Without Stress, which is exactly what I think a lot of people are trying to achieve. Because we get this idea in our head that success will make us happy and success will solve X, Y, and Z. And it does solve some things, but it also, you don't ever envision the other host of issues that it brings up, or how, like, the toll that it will take on you, or how much stress.
Tell me about the toll that it takes on you.
Well, the toll just being, you know, more responsibility is more things to think about, more things to mess up, you know.
Higher stakes.
Then once you have the success, I don't want to lose it, you know. Yeah. So people get very protective and they get very scared. And also, I think when people get out of their, you know, I think people kind of have a comfort zone of wherever they think they deserve. And if they get below or above that, they freak out.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
That's a good insight. It's true.
They lose themselves. They lose themselves. And then this thing that they thought was supposed to solve them doesn't solve them, which creates even more stress. Like, why am I not better? I have all these things I thought I wanted. And then, you know, it's not hard to see why people just go into a steep slide of a crash or drugs or whatever.
And the other thing is I think a lot of those people, because I teach some of them, is that there's a guilt. Like, wait a minute, I've got all this fame, or I've got all this money, or I've got all this power, all this influence. I'm not happy.
Right.
Matter of fact, it's not even not happy. The anxiety and the stress that the toll it took them to get to that point, now when they've got it, they're not themselves.
They're just joyful.
No joke, because they're stressed out by their own admission. They can't sleep. They're anxious all the time. And so had you tried any other form of meditation?
I did what a lot of people do, which is I downloaded like the Headspace app or the Mind, or, you know, different apps, thinking like, I'm going to get to this. But like so many things in life, I think people think it's more of a thing than it is. Oh, I have to, what do I have to get, like a, do I have to have a meditation pillow and a quiet room and incense and, you know, dimmed light? You can, but you don't have to. There's really no...
I meditate in the backseat of taxis. I've meditated at Yankee Stadium. You can meditate anywhere where you close your eyes and sit comfortably.
How do you meditate at Yankee Stadium?
It was a boring game. It was a beautiful summer afternoon. It was a boring game. I moved out. There weren't that many people. I moved out to the left field line, and it was 4 in the afternoon, and I really wanted to meditate because I was going right out. And, you know, the thing is, you hear the music, there wasn't any cheering, it was a bad game, but in between innings, and you just meditate. And as you know, every experience is different.
Yes.
You're not trying to, and there's this beautiful, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is a physicist who became a great meditation teacher, but his training was physicist. And someone asked him once, they had learned to meditate, and he said, well, you know, some meditations feel deeper and some meditations are more on the surface. Are the deeper ones better? And he said, they're both good. And the guy said, how's that possible? And Maharishi said, because even in a shallow dive, we get wet.
That's a very yogi thing to say.
Yeah. And it's true, though. So I just did it. And it's not the same as if I was in my room, sitting up in my bed or sitting in a chair, but it was a heck of a lot better than not doing it.
Well, I think it's also, again, because I've talked about this with a lot of my friends, too. It's more the sum total.
Yes.
It's not
cumulative.
It's cumulative.
Effect.
And
yes.
So it doesn't... You know, if you're putting too much strain on the what it's supposed to feel like, I think that's a sign that you're too result oriented,
and you're not doing TM.
And you're not doing TM because you're not just sort of moving with it, and so it does. I think that's important for people to know too, which is why I think rather than just grabbing an app, you know, either reading your book or doing a little bit of research online to just sort of get a better sense. Because once you understand what it is, then it just solves all of those other things that crowd your brain, that get in the way.
I'll give an explanation.
Yes, please.
Okay, so I like to use an analogy. You're on a little boat, and you're in the middle of the ocean, and all of a sudden you got these huge 30, 40, 50-foot high waves. and you could think, oh my God, the whole ocean is in upheaval. But if you did a cross-section of that ocean out there, you'd realize you got these 30-foot waves, but the ocean in reality is over a mile deep, and while the surface of the ocean may be turbulent, the depth of the ocean, by its nature, is pretty darn silent.
Except for comedians who, in their brains, have sea monsters down at the bottom.
Yeah, that's right, of course. But these are actually the quietest below the sea monster.
Yes.
So the whole purpose of meditation throughout the ages has been to, quote-unquote, bring equanimity to the mind. For the longest time, researchers thought all meditations were the same, but it turns out they're not. There's three basic types. I'll go into that.
Please.
First type is called focused attention, and that's your classic, at the end of a yoga class, the guy, the woman, or the guy says, okay, now we're going to meditate, clear your mind of thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I thought, okay, then I'll create peace in the Middle East, because I got a very busy mind.
Right.
And that's like trying to forcibly stop the waves on the surface of the ocean to bring calm. Create, if you want a calm mind, stop thinking. If you want a calm ocean, stop waves. Very hard to do. But when you do it, brain research shows that it creates something called, science alert here, gamma brain waves, which are 20 to 50 cycles per second, and it just shows you're working really hard. Second type of meditation is mindfulness, open monitoring. In that ocean analogy, it's learning to observe the waves rise and fall dispassionately, not getting too excited when the wave is high, not getting too depressed when the wave is low. So we learn how to observe our thoughts, observe our breath, be in the moment.
Right.
And in the moment is a degree, hopefully, of some equanimity. Science alert, when you do that, it creates theta brain waves, which are like pre-onset dream. Transcendental meditation, completely different. Now it gets interesting again.
People do like the science alerts, by the way.
So, the first two are what's called, I love this stuff actually, cognitive processes.
Mm-hmm.
Focused attention and open monitoring. That cognitive process means pertaining to thoughts, feelings, and emotions, the waves. How to adapt and adjust to the waves so that you feel some calm. In transcendental meditation, those things are fine. We just leave them as they are. We hypothesize, because there's no belief system here. We hypothesize that deep within every human being right now is a level where the mind is already settled and calm and wide awake. That's the hypothesis, even below the sea monsters, way in there. It's there. We've lost access to it. Sometimes we access it in sports, when you're performing, the zone. Again, you're holding a child in your arms, in a relationship, a partner. There's a moment of unity, something very special you never forget, but it's rare. In transcendental meditation, we learn a technique to access that vertical dimension of the mind, that inner quiet and calm. Move in that direction. Obviously, as you know, that doesn't happen in every or most meditations. But in the word transcend means to settle down, to go from that choppy surface level of the ocean a little calmer, deeper, deeper. And when that happens, science alert, final science alert, the brainwave activity, electrical activity of the brain, complete change, something called alpha 1, which is like the perfect state of 8 to 10 cycles per second, where the mind is deeply settled. You can still have thoughts, but deeply settled and wide awake. And that is the perfect state after meditation for creativity, for learning, for listening, for being present, because it's a settled, wide awake, energized mind. And that's what. And then there's something called neuroplasticity, the brain waves that happen, the connections that take place during your TM in the brain last out of the brain after the meditation.
Which is why you do it twice a day.
Yeah.
I try to do it twice a day.
You do the best you can.
I do the best I can.
You do the best you can. Do you do mornings regularly or afternoon?
I do mornings right after I wake up.
Perfect.
And because I was told that if you do it after you eat, like it's the digestion process can get in the way
a little bit.
It's
a stimulant. Digesting is like raises your metabolic rate, and during TM, your metabolic rate wants to settle down.
And then when I can, I'll try to do it in the late afternoon, you know, before dinner or before, you know.
Jerry Seinfeld, you mentioned him. He had been meditating, he started when he was 17. So he'd been meditating about 40 years, and I got a call that he wanted me to teach his wife and his kids. And So I was teaching him, and it takes about an hour a day over four consecutive days, as you know. And after one meeting, he joined us in the kitchen. I taught him at his house. And I said, so you do your morning meditation at when you wake up, and then your afternoon meditation sometime before dinner. And he said, there's two meditations? He had forgotten. He'd only been doing one. So he started his second one, just squeezed it in. And he said it's worth 2 hours of sleep. And he said if he was still doing twice, if he had done twice a day before, Seinfeld would still be on the air. It has been a complete game changer for him, because he says for him, the most important, he said, you can have the most creative ideas. If you don't have the energy to do it, the clear, crystal clear, sustained, laser-like energy, you can't get anything done.
No. Or you'll shoot a lot of the ideas down.
That's right.
Oh, I just can't. I don't want to be bothered.
And that's what he said, the second meditation. This is a subtle hint. The second, that was, listener, that was
good
a subtle
for,
hint.
Subtle hint alert. Yeah. It's good enough for Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Well, also because a lot of people will say, like, well, I don't have time to do, and like the I don't have time argument always drives me a little crazy, because I feel like you have you can prioritize anything that's meaningful to you, you know, for the most part. I mean, you know, when I was in college, I was broke, but I always had money for drinking. You know what I mean? Like, how did I do that? I don't know. But you find whatever is important to you. So if you can make it a part of your routine.
Somebody told me once, they said, there's 1,440 minutes in a day. If you don't have 40 minutes to take care of yourself in a profound way, he said, you need to reprioritize. There's an ancient meditation thing that said, if you don't have 20 minutes to meditate, then you need to meditate for an hour.
Well, you know, people now are such, like, we're so addicted to distraction and busyness. Like, we say we're busy, but I feel like we're not really doing, like, most of the time, we're not really doing anything. Like, I think if most people really sort of looked at how much time they spend on their devices all day. It's like, was all of that, you know, could you cut 20 or 40 minutes out of that?
And the thing is also is when you have meditated, it sharpens the mind so you get more done in less time. You're not distracted. You don't make so many mistakes. And you don't need so many distractions because your mind is more settled. But I also think we're coming to a point now. Someone asked me, why is there so much interest in TM these days? And I said, there's three reasons. The problem of stress is real, 24/7, unrelenting, the political climate. It's killing our kids more than even us, but it's devastating. And the kind of stresses that we're collecting now in our 20s and 30s and 40s, that's actually, when they look at people who have Alzheimer's or high blood pressure, it started in the 20s.
Wow.
It didn't start, if they're 70, it didn't start at 65. It's a gradual residue that builds up and builds up and builds up. And we all find it inside ourselves. You know, we're not as resilient as we used to be. Those people pushing our buttons more than they used to. I'm not sleeping as well as I used to. You know, just people know that. Or I need more cups of coffee or more glasses of wine. And so the problem of stress is quite severe, and our understanding of what it does to us is quite gruesome. Also, secondly, there, as I said, there's no pill.
Right.
There's no pill we can take.
Right.
And then the third reason is there's so much research now on TM. Just this week, the week of November 15th, one of the top medical journals in the world called Lancet Psychiatry is coming out with a major study on transcendental meditation for vets who have post-traumatic stress. And it shows that TM is more effective than anything that the VA has ever used, from medications to therapy to prolonged exposure to mindfulness, more effective. And I think within a few years, there's 700,000 vets with post-traumatic stress disorder. I think within 3 years, they'll all be able to learn TM for free.
Well, and it's also learning how to not be reactive. Like most people, you know, again, I think we're being conditioned on social media that it's not only like a right to react to everything, but it's our duty to react to everything on, you know, at set to 11. And we're taking that out into the real world too. And again, I just think there's so much information that we're trying to process that never in the history of mankind have we ever had to process this much information at once. And we're just overstimulated. Our brains can't process all of it.
No.
Every single
day. And the ones who can handle it the least are the kids.
Yeah.
Who are subject to the same input, the same 24/7. Did you know that it's a horrible statistic, the number two cause of death among teenagers in America today is suicide.
Jesus.
And that the fastest rate within that are girls 13 to 16 because they're cyberbullying, all this stuff. The world, because their brains, the frontal lobe, which is the sort of adult brain, which is the prefrontal cortex, size of your fist right behind the forehead, that doesn't start coming online, and that's judgment and planning and decision-making, really until a child is 12, 13, 14 and doesn't finish coming online until the person's 26. So that ability to discriminate, to discern, to say, oh, you know, mommy and daddy are fighting, it's not my fault, but right. The kid thinks it's my fault. So, you know, it's like everything is, it's such an internalized
world. Oh, and
then
that just gets cemented in there. And then that's what you go to therapy for in your 30s and 40s.
They call it ACE, Adverse Childhood Experience. A divorce, parents fighting, somebody in the family taking serious drugs. They say three ACEs, three Adverse Childhood Experiences, is a pipeline to either drug abuse, psychiatric, mental health disorders, even violence, crime, because the child, it's scarring the brain at an early age. That's why I help head up the David Lynch Foundation, which is started by the filmmaker David Lynch, and we established it 14 years ago with the idea of bringing TM to every at-risk child in America who would like to learn to meditate. Well, it's taken us 14 years, but now we're at 1 million kids we've taught. And that's not just in the U.S., but in Latin America, in the Middle East. Our office, where we are right now, is two blocks away from the United Nations. We're talking to them about bringing TM to 1 million Syrian refugees. I think this is a medical intervention. So not only is it not a cult or something weird, it's actually an effective medical intervention that can address very serious problems that are either caused by stress or exacerbated by stress.
Yeah, and also, you know, people tend to be motivated to action when they hit, not necessarily when they hit bottom, but when something happens that so profoundly affects them. And I'm sure a lot of people feel that now, but also maybe don't necessarily wait until that happens.
What was going on in your life that you decided?
Oh, I just felt overstimulated. Like, I just felt I was working on a million things in a million directions. You know, more successful than I ever thought I would be. And it was exactly where it's like I wasn't feeling joyful. I was just feeling overstressed. Like, now I got to be here and I got to do this and I got to not screw this up. And then this is happening. And what's this over there? Like, my brain was a utility closet and there was just no more room. There was no more room for anything. Yeah. And so,
By the way, excuse me, dear listener, my brain was a utility closet and there was no more room is an excellent visual.
That's what it felt like.
Excellent visual. It's just I like to think of a rag bag for myself, but I think a utility is a little more dignified to have a utility.
And also, anything can go in it. So you don't know what's in there. You know, it's probably a bowling ball in my case, and then some, you know, movie props and a bunch of stuff. But you know, there's just, and so then what was happening is that I just felt like, oh well, I'm not necessarily being present for life or the people that, you know, I've only been married for 2 years. Like, I need to. What do I do? Like, how do I? I felt like my brain was in a knot, several knots on knots, and I couldn't get it to unknot. And so I had enough painful motivation of I need to do something. And so, you know, that's why I just say to people, like, just even if the idea is that you feel more exhausted every day than you think you should, or even if you think you should feel exhausted, wouldn't it be nice to just feel a little less exhausted all day? Like, even if it's a small percentage, isn't it worth it?
Yeah. And it's like such a simple, such an easy, that's another thing. So many meditations, when I was talking about those three types, focused attention, and it's difficult to try and clear the mind of thoughts. It's difficult. Transcendental meditation I like to think of it as it's as effortless. You teach a child how to dive. You say, honey, stand by the side of the pool, lean over like that, take the correct angle, and then let go. And then gravity takes over. So in transcendental meditation, the mind is naturally drawn to something more satisfying. Many people in meditation, I think, misunderstanding, oh, it's a monkey mind. You got to stop your mind from wandering. You got to corral the monkey mind. And that's not the case. Mind doesn't wander aimlessly. You're sitting in a room and you're doing some wretched, boring work, and in the other room, a phenomenal song comes on, your attention is just drawn to that beautiful music, fabulous music. Or you go on a vacation and you bring two books, and one book should never have been published. It's a blight against mankind. You can't read a word. The other book is just killer. Hours go by. So your mind, by its own nature, will go to something more satisfying. But the problem is, it's always out through the senses. Oh, that job will make me happy. That restaurant will make me happy. That concert will make me happy. That gig will make me happy. But it doesn't last.
Right.
Inside, if there's an inside, we hypothesize, my own quiet self, very satisfying place. So in transcendental meditation, like that dive, we learn how to give the attention of the mind an inward direction. And just effortlessly, we settle down. And what do you feel most? Rest. Right? You feel physical rest.
And it's also, there are also other ancillary effects, I think, which are that it's empowering to know that in an uncontrollable world, you can still control those, like you can control that these 20 minutes, I'm going to do this thing, and I know what the result is going to be.
There's this great thing. I was in my book, I was doing some research for my book. I was doing some research, and they say, stress. There's actually three components to stress. There are stressors, things we have no control over. Political change, social change, economic change, relationships change, child gets sick, wife, upset, all partner upset, all these. Those are stressors. Those are outside, overwhelming experiences. The thing we have control over, they call the stress response. How do I react to those
right.
things? If I'm exhausted, beaten down, worn out, not eating well, somebody writes me 10 words on a snarky words on a text message, and I thought they were my friend, and I see those 10 words. Now, if I'm on top of my game, I read those 10 words, I go, oh, she must have not felt well.
Right.
So that's the thing you have control over, how I react.
Right.
And when I can't, when I'm overwhelmed, that creates the stress, and that hits me. On the muscles, my muscles get tense, my jaw tightens up, or I get a headache, or my stomach tightens up, or, is this too much detail?
No,
okay,
perfect.
Cortisol levels, that's the stress hormone, it's a science alert. Cortisol is a stress hormone that's secreted by the adrenal glands that sit on top of the kidneys. When we're overwhelmed, the body secretes cortisol to sort of, so we react.
Right.
Well, and then, but it makes us anxious, nervous. And then we secrete more cortisol and more anxiety and more cortisol and more anxiety. And too much cortisol, which most people have, it shuts down memory. It compromises the immune system. That's why if a person is stressed, they get sick a lot. Doesn't allow us to digest food. So it's a disaster. And the third, so the first is tension. The second is cortisol. And the third is it actually shuts down, takes offline the executive functioning of your brain. Does a stressed person make good decisions?
No.
No, because that part of the brain is offline.
Well, because when if you were being chased by a lion, you don't always, historically, you wouldn't stop to assess the lion's state of mind.
Well, that's about a 195-pound lion.
Well, if he wants to have a conversation about it, it's like you just have to react. You have to react.
No.
You have to run.
That shuts down. All the blood and the energy and everything goes to your muscles to run. The problem is we react to that for nothing. So we're overreacting to for nothing. And the problem on that is it kills us. When the body is hyperactivated, when the amygdala, which is the part of your brain which is your fight or flight,
yep.
is chronically overactivated, and it leads to high levels of 60 million Americans with depression, and a lot of younger people. A lot of millennials, because it gets internalized, anxiety, depression. So the point of all this is transcendental meditation, I don't think, is a luxury. It's not just for people in the Upper East Side or Beverly Hills or whatever. This is something it's a tool to access a mechanism of profound rest and rejuvenation at will. And so just going back again with the David Lynch Foundation, I think the work that we're doing and the research that's coming out, I think in a few years, TM is going to be offered in all the insurance coverage.
Oh, that would be amazing.
No, it's going to happen.
That would really be amazing. And you think that's brewing right now?
Oh, no, because all it and the reason for it is, the reason why a medication gets covered by an insurance company is that that medication, even with its hazard, many have hazardous side effects, has been subjected to what's called a phase 3 clinical trial. That's with 1,000 people, randomized control trial in 3 or 4 different parts of the country, and it's independent research. And when that shows that that lowers high blood pressure or lowers cholesterol or whatever, then that's sufficient for the government to reimburse in Medicare or for Aetna to reimburse with insurance. Transcendental meditation, we're just starting those phase 3 trials. And within 2 or 3 years, it'll be the same. It'll be seen as a medical intervention for physical health, for mental health. Absolutely.
A lot of what you're saying intersects with, I've been reading a lot of Stoic philosophy.
And tell me about it.
Well, just exactly what you were saying before about, you know, placing value externally versus what you control is how you interpret things, how you react to things. And there is a parallel between why I think there's an explosion of TM. You know, historically, Stoicism tends to pop back up during periods of stress because people are just like, what do I do? What am I doing? What is happening? You know, and we're definitely in a what am I doing? What is happening? And besides the fact that I think the world is a particularly crazy place right now, we're so hyper aware of all of it, more so than at any other time. And so then that elevates all of it as well.
I taught this one Muslim cleric. I was in the Middle East, and you know he was a devout Muslim, and he learned TM and he loved it. And he said, "You know, 5 years ago, I never would have done this." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I mistakenly would have thought it would be opposed to my religion." And I said, "Well, why did you?" He said, "I know it's not now, but I said, well, why did you learn?" He said, "Because I haven't slept in 5 years."
Oh my God!
And so he started meditating, and then he slept, yeah. And then he loved, you know, and he became a better Muslim, healthier. And there's in the ancient text, they talk about there's two yogas. There's why do people get on a path to take care of themselves to meditate? One is called the yoga of enlightenment. And that is, oh, I want to learn to meditate because I'm already creative, but I want to be more creative and right. I'm happy. And the other is called the yoga of desperation.
I know that one.
Yeah. And that's
what
why
am I
most
do?
People start. Yeah, because no one wants to suffer. No one wants to have headaches. No one wants to, you know, go out with friends and be distracted, or be with your child and you're not really with your child, or have all this comfort around you and feel depressed or anxious. Or nobody wants it. And so, and medicine isn't giving us a magic. There's no polio vaccine amongst medicine. So people are looking to TM.
Yeah, I don't think there's any drug that wouldn't have enormous side effects. Then that's the problem.
They all do.
It's like, yeah, and then people are taking these cocktails of drugs because one gets them too up, and so they have to come down, and then yeah. Another one. And then, you know, people are taking 3, 4, 5 different medications at the same time just to try to get even. And, you know, obviously there are certain cases where people definitely need to take medications to stabilize. But I think there are more people on medications than necessarily need to be on medications if people could understand different techniques for a sort of quieting, and certainly in the creative communities, you know, because in creative communities, it's not just the creation part of the brain, but it's also the judgment part of the brain and the external judgment part of the brain, and being able to see being judged in real time. I mean, they're just things that our poor, frail human psyches just... It's just too much for us, you know?
So, can I do another science alert?
You can do as many science alerts as you want. Now it's a thing. Yeah. And I'm going to... Now that you're saying that's going to be my ringtone. So it's fine.
So, creativity. And the people... We were talking about all the comedians and artists and performers who practice TM. And for some of them, who've been doing it for a long time, whether it's a Jerry Seinfeld or a Howard Stern for 45 years or... Paul McCartney as an entertainer, or Ringo, people who've got to the top and stayed at the top, which is really tough, and they credit meditation TM for that. And so I'm very interested in the parts of the brain that are related to creativity. And they used to think So they used to think that, oh, you're a creative type, you're a right brain person. Remember that?
Right.
You're right. And yeah. if you're the number cruncher and you're the scientist, well, I'm a left brain. You know, I don't go along with that nonsense. I'm a left brain person. Well, it turns out that's not true. It turns out that creativity is not lodged in a region of the brain. Creativity is a product of connections within networks in the brain. Because the back and the front and all the different parts of the brain communicating together is what brings out creativity. And there's two main networks. Is this interesting?
Yes.
Okay. There's two main networks. One is called, we talked about it before, it's the attention network or the prefrontal cortex, and that is executive functioning. And that's judgment and decision-making and planning, and that's focus. You know, it's like pen to paper. You've been, you know, getting it down, getting it, you got a book, or you got some project. Now, that's where the brain is really working hard to focus. So the scientists wondered, well, what's the brain doing when we're not focused, when we're not burning the midnight oil? What does the brain default to? So they came up with a very innovative name for that, what the brain does. They called it the default mode network.
Wait a minute. How did they come up with it?
I have no idea.
I mean, there must have been committees of people.
No, they had focus groups.
I want to go home. Can we just call it the default running? Yeah, I'm tired too.
Okay. Yeah. So they thought it was just this sort of the brain was doing nothing. Well, it turns out it's also they now have renamed it the imagination network. It's the part of the brain. It's like when you blue sky, when you brainstorm, when you're taking a hot shower and then great ideas come, when you're out for a walk. It's the part of the brain that's not structured and focused. And the attention network, or the focus part, is in the front of the brain. This imagination network is actually in the center of the brain. And it connects your past experiences, your future plans, your sense of self. And that's where good ideas bubble up. Now, stress knocks them both out. Just, if you're too stressed, you don't get those creative ideas. If you're too stressed, you can't focus. Too stressed. Most people, getting around to TM here, most people have either the ability in the creative process to focus or brainstorm. One or the other. There's a part of the brain that shuts down the brainstorm so you can focus, and vice versa. Study that was done, it was published January 2018, and you can read it online. Go to Google and you can look up imagination network, creativity. The most creative people in the world have both networks functioning simultaneously in an integrated way. The ability to focus and pivot.
Is that learned?
Transcendental meditation is one of the few things they've ever found that wakes up both those networks in the brain.
Yeah, because I also think it's important to define what stress is, because I think colloquially stress means something bad happened. Oh, I'm in trouble at work. But I think stress is just stuff. Stress is just anything
too much stuff.
Taxes your.
Yes, that's right.
Asking your brain to perform a task.
People win a lottery and die of a heart attack.
Of course they do. Yeah. So it's just
too much. It's just too much.
So that's when people say, like, well, I have everything I want. Why am I stressed? It's like, well, you have a lot. It's just stuff. There's just a lot of stuff. And what you're talking about with the network sounds like the difference between saying, I'm going to get from downtown to uptown at 5 p.m. on a Friday versus I'm going to drive across town on Christmas Day when there's no cars.
It's just
finding a technique to clear out all the traffic.
And what TM does is that you could say effortlessly exercises those creative networks in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't do that, if you don't do that, then you're not as creative as you could be. You want to pick up a heavy box. If you haven't exercised the muscles, you can't pick. You can't pick up the box. You exercise the muscles, pick up the box.
Right.
You want to be creative. You want to be innovative. You want to pivot. You want to be able to go. You're doing stand up, and you've got your 30 minutes of material. Some guy in the audience yells out something. Bam! You're off. You're off on that one.
Right.
As opposed to, oh, I can't handle that,
right.
And that's it. So that's what that is. And so I look at TM as just. It's just connections in the brain.
Yeah, and also, I mean, as I would imagine that most people
especially most people listening to this podcast, just feel like
they
have
no idea what we're talking about.
I have a pretty decent idea. But people just feel like they're just hitting a wall.
Yeah.
They're just hitting a wall, whether bad things are happening, whether good things are happening, whether nothing is happening. They're just hitting that wall. And I just think that is symptomatic of being, you're just taxing your brain too much, and that it can be just as simple
and
as
what, yes,
relaxing.
And what you're taxing your brain is particularly the focus part. You're just wearing yourself out. Focus, trying, pushing. And that's why, you know, if you have a child and they're getting stressed out on a homework project, you say, you know, little Jimmy or little Janet, you know, let's go out to dinner. Let's go for a walk. Let's go for a swim. Or, your partner says, let's go away for the weekend. It's counterproductive.
Yeah.
Because when you strain and focus too much, push too hard, it ends up shutting down that part, like taking that part of the brain offline, and it suppresses the imagination network. So if you want to look at something like TM for just reducing cortisol levels by 30%, fine. But I think looking at what it does for, like, just awakening the connections in the brain for creativity. It's not magic.
I mean, for you, because there was a gray area that I didn't, because this is a big leap, but you learned TM at Berkeley, is that right? When you were like
18.
And then it says...
I'm now 21.
And then, yeah, you've done a lot of great things in 3 years.
I know.
And then Bob went to Spain, maybe, or Europe. You went to study with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. But there's a lot of great, like, how do you discover it at 18? How do you implement it at 18 and then go, okay, well, now I'm studying with this person?
Okay, so it's a very interesting story, which I touch on in the book. I grew up in a very political family in the 1950s and 1960s in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say my family was so political that I knew I was a Democrat before I knew I was Jewish. I did. So, you know, and so we were, you know, John Kennedy, we talked about John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, how could he do that? And then when I was in high school, I'm going to get to TM in a moment.
Fine.
I'll give you a background. When I was in high school, I worked for Bobby Kennedy in California. And he was running for the Democratic nomination for president. And I remember clearly on June 1st, 1968, going to the San Francisco Civic Auditorium with 2,000 other people and hearing Bobby Kennedy speak and listening to Bobby Darin, who sang, and thinking, looking around. It wasn't that I was a Republican or a Democrat. I thought, wow, I'm on to something. You know, I've always been interested in social transformation, equality among, that's just always been my thing growing up. And I thought, this is something significant. And then 4 days later, he was gone. Assassinated in L.A. So I went to Berkeley in September 1968 with the intention of going to law school and becoming a U.S. senator like Bobby Kennedy and changing laws. Because I thought laws, legislation, that's how you get social transformation. 2 months at Berkeley in 1968, when the polarization then made me realize that politics was never going to heal the soul of the nation. You might get stuff done, but at considerable cost. And I still believe in politics, just not my avenue. So then I thought education. I'm getting to TM.
No, please.
Okay. So I thought education. My mom was an educator. And I thought, I'll write educational curriculum to give, I was really concerned about inner city school kids, to give them tools that they could get from kindergarten on up to help them navigate an increasingly insane world even 50 years ago. So I'm going to school full-time. I'm working full-time. There are Vietnam War riots outside my door, tanks parked outside my door. And I wasn't a druggie, and I wasn't a fanatic and a crazy person. I was just a guy who wanted to make a better world. I was stressed. So I had a job at a Swenson's ice cream parlor.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Swenson's.
The best.
I remember Swenson's.
I gave away more free ice cream at Swenson's.
So, that's really fun. Actually, just sort of hearing all that, like, okay, if I can't make laws, I'm going to give away ice cream.
Yes, I know. Anyway, so, but the irony of, you know, how serendipitous is how nature, you know, the universe works. So I'm going to school full time. I'm working full time. And my dad wants me to work. So I'm, and there was a guy there, Peter Stevens, who was normal, really good guy, not crazy. And there was something about him that was special. You know, he had an equanimity about him that I had not seen in anybody else. And I heard he did transcendental meditation. It was not a word in my vocabulary. My first thought was, I have enough issues with my own religion.
Right.
And then I talked to him about it. I went and heard a talk. The teacher said I could be 100% skeptical. I thought, I'll learn it. It's an hour a day over 4 days. If I don't like it, I'll quit. And one of my first experiences from my first meditation was, oh, this is what I'm going to teach kids.
Oh, wow.
So that was June 28th, 1969. So I went to, you know, finished my education and meditated. And then I heard that there was actually I had 1 year left. I got credit, college credit, to spend 5 months on a TM teacher training course, like sort of, and with Maharishi, who was great. He was a physicist by training and a great meditation teacher. And then I became a teacher, and I came back, and one of the first things I did is I went to the schools in San Francisco, these inner city schools, and I went to San Quentin Prison, and I taught inmates on death row. And I also later on taught it at Apple Computer and General Motors. And I just continued to teach, but always in the back of my mind was, I want to bring this to kids. So 14 years ago, I was friends with David Lynch, who's been meditating almost as long as me, 40 plus years. I said, let's start a foundation. Let's raise money. Let's bring this to kids who need it the most. And now we got 1 million kids meditating.
When you're studying with Maharishi, because I'm sure a lot of people have this sort of like very romantic idea in their mind about is he just a guy that you're hanging out with, just having regular conversations?
It's a really great question. First of all, I was there with like 1,000 other people. It was like a big course from all over the world. There was a conference where there was Maharishi, and on his right was this fellow, Brian Josephson, who was a Nobel laureate in physics.
Okay.
And then next to him was a fellow named Dr. Ilya Prigogine, who was a Nobel laureate in biochemistry. And then on his left was a top priest, rabbi, and an imam. And Maharishi was in the middle, and they were talking about ultimate truths. Ultimate, like, what's real beneath the veneer? You know, what does physics say? What is the ancient meditation text? And I sat there, and I thought, my God, this could be any time. This could be Lao Tzu. This could be the time of Plato, Socrates. Any time in history when people were trying to go, what are the deep, immutable truths of life? So being around Maharishi, people thought, oh, he was never this like guru type person. He was just wise beyond, and insightful and kind, and knew as much about physics and as much about the ancient truths. So it was and I had over 40 years. I had an opportunity to go back many times and be around him, study, work. So yeah, it was remarkable.
What are they talking about on that panel? Like, what are they?
Beautiful question. So, in the Bible, it says, "Seek ye, the kingdom of heaven is within you, and seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all else will be added unto thee." And Buddhist philosophy talks about, or Chinese philosophy talks about, this field, this deep underlying field of unity. Quantum physics talks about a unified field. and that Einstein spent the latter years of his life, okay, we see atoms. Are atoms the ultimate building blocks of the universe? Well, it turns out not. There's particles. And it turns out there's something deeper. And it turns out there's something deeper. And then it turns out there's four fields: gravity, electromagnetism, mm-hmm. Weak interaction, strong interaction, and then what's underneath that? So this quest to know, just a human quest to know what's under, where'd this come from? They were talking about the same things that the people, these ancient, you know, spiritual texts were talking about. So Maharishi was just sort of navigating this fascinating conversation because the ancient texts say, I know it's a long answer, you can access that field at the quietest level of your own consciousness. Because quantum physics doesn't say that. Quantum physics says you'll never, ever access that field of unbounded power, energy, creativity, that gives rise to the whole universe. But the ancient meditation texts say the human brain is that instrument, properly cultured, that you can access that. And when you access it, not only do you know who you are, that's know thyself, but you know the truth of life. So it was a wonderful, amazing conversations.
I mean, when you come back to teach that...
I don't. I just come back and teach a technique that gives people...
You do teach a technique, but essentially you're giving people a key to unlock whatever that is in themselves.
Yes.
And you're obviously, you know, you especially if you're... How old are you, like at 20 at that point, or 8 years?
21. 21.
21, so you're just... You hadn't totally solidified yet, but here you are, this young, impressionable guy who's just brimming with, like, oh, I think I figured something out. Yeah. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think this is the way there. Although, so how much has your meditation evolved? Does it still feel like the same experience as it always felt, or do you feel like it grows, you go deeper, you've gone deeper than you've ever been, or does it just always...
No, it's a wonderful question. It definitely deepens, but what changes most dramatically is my life. It's like you water a little sapling, and you water it, maybe you put a little less, but you water it, and now the little sapling's got bark and a trunk, and now it's got leaves, and now it's got flowers, and now it's got fruit, and now it's bigger and bigger. You're doing the same thing. You're just the same. Basically, you're watering the root. You're putting water on dirt. You're nourishing that plant at its roots, at its core, at the level of the sap, and the results are huge. So I find from my meditations are great. I enjoy them. They're fine. When I got a lot going on, I wrote a book. I have a lot of thoughts. I don't care that even in a shallow dive you get wet. There's still that settling down. But for me, the transformation is how I live my life. You know, the insight, the quiet, the calm. Because the ocean, I use that analogy, the ocean is not either the waves or the silence. The ocean is both. The ocean is not either or.
Right.
So I am both that surface, I got a mind, but I'm also that unbounded, infinite, eternal silence that is within me and within everyone else. That's what changes, and that's where the satisfaction grows in life. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And it also, for people who want to learn or study, if they don't necessarily have the resources wherever they live, like where, because when I started learning, I'm so glad that I had Lynn as an instructor.
Lynn Kaplan, fabulous teacher.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Because...
Loves you.
Oh, I think she's great. I really adore her. And yeah. And I will go in, you know, people go like, oh, do you have to keep paying money? I'm like, no, it's not, I'm telling you, it's not a pyramid scheme. But
it's like the branding on TM is so abysmal.
I think it's changing, though. It's definitely...
Believe me, over 50 years.
Yeah, it's definitely changing. Yeah. But, you know, something that I experienced early on was that when I would shut my eyes, some of my most stressful thoughts would just bubble to the surface. And it was, you know, it was a little unpleasant at first. And being able to work with her to understand techniques like, you know, here's how you can get around that. Here's how you process it. Here's how you deal with it. Because, you know, if someone who's listening just goes, fine, I'll shut my eyes. And then it either doesn't feel good or it isn't this or it isn't that or it doesn't meet their expectations. I just don't want people to immediately go, well, I tried that once. No, I'm not going to do it anymore.
No, and the thing that's interesting is people go nuts. They say, well, why is it? We can talk about the money in a moment. Why is it you don't need a teacher and just take a sound and just do it yourself? It's such a trivialization of what the power of what meditation can be. Like, it's just thinking repeating some sound. But to actually transcend, you can't see my hand, but I'm like diving, to actually access those quieter levels of the mind, it helps enormously to have a guide, a teacher. If you want to learn how to swim, it helps to have a teacher. If you want to learn to play violin, you have a teacher. It just teachers are like, that's life. It's good to have a teacher. And in transcendental meditation, you'd have a teacher. It takes about an hour a day over 4 days. He or she is your own teacher, will give you a mantra, which is a word or a sound that has no meaning, that's over 7,000 years old. It's been used for thousands of years for this diving within, and then teach you how to use it properly. And as you said, that you have a teacher, Lynn or myself or anybody, for the rest of your life. There's no dues anytime in the world if you have a question. And it's not just swimming on the surface. TM is not just a thing where I'm just repeating a sound or watching my breath. Those are focused attention, open monitoring, as I said during my science alert at the beginning of the conversation.
That's your podcast, by the way. Science Alert with Bob Roth.
Anyway, so it helps to, it's wonderful to have a teacher and have a teacher for the rest of your life.
And I think it's also learning how to, I mean, like, would you rather be the passenger of your life or the driver of your life?
Oh, man.
You know?
Yes.
And I did find that after I started, there were situations that I feel like I would have been reactive to that I was able to feel some separation from and go, okay, you know, is this thing that happened in traffic maybe not that big of a deal?
Yeah. And if the amygdala, which is the fear center or the fight or flight, if that's like a fire alarm in your brain that's going on all the time, hyper aroused all the time, react, 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 fear, 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 then you are overreacting to everything. Something happens to you at 9 in the morning that pissed you off. Well, now it's 6 in the afternoon. You're still raging. And the people you're meeting with at six in the afternoon had nothing to do with that.
Right.
Are the beneficiaries of your quote unquote beneficiaries. So I love to do it, even though it's a little too science alerty. But I love to say that when you're talking about these changes, it's not, oh, you've adopted a new philosophy of life. The same thing, if suddenly you can bench press 100 pounds or 200 pounds, it's because your muscles are stronger. If you're not overreacting, it's because your brain is functioning the way it should function, not distorted by stress and tension and fatigue and trauma.
And I also think that
anybody still listening?
Yes,
to the show?
Of course they are. I guarantee you that they're, and one of the reasons why I was so, well, first of all, I just wanted to meet you and say thank you. And then also, I know that there are a percentage of people out there, and I don't know what the number is, but I know that there are a percentage of people out there, they're going to hear this, and it's going to click. Like, it's just the right time for them to hear it, and it's going to dramatically change their lives, which is why, you know, which is why it's important for me to
share this. It's wonderful you use this platform that you've built up because of your own integrity and your own creativity and your own truthfulness. That to bring out these points, it's great.
Well, yeah, because
nothing changes.
Dangerous levels of stress and that are happening in the world, and I do think that something really nice happens when you do things for yourself. Because even just on from the standpoint of, oh, I deserve something good. I'm doing something for myself because I think I deserve that. Because most people don't think they deserve good things. And most people will destroy anything that's good because they don't, you know, and they don't even realize they're the catalyst of their own destruction because subconsciously somewhere someone told them they were a piece of shit in their lives and they just, like, that's cemented, like we talked about, and so they just think, this is what I deserve, this is what I deserve.
There's an amazing book called The Body Keeps the Score. And that is...
I love the title.
Yeah, The Body Keeps the Score. And that is talking about stress and trauma. That you can have something happen to you when you're in grade school, at home, something happens in life that is actually traumatic, that you've forgotten. It's washed from your memory, but it's not washed from your body.
Right.
That etching, that engravement, that stress, that trauma is there. And that skews. That's what makes us not react. You know, it's like not trust a relationship. You know, repeatedly make the same mistakes in a relationship or repeatedly be self-deprecating when not necessarily, whatever, have self-doubt because the nervous system, the brain, the whole system is not functioning in an integrated, healthy way. It's been twisted. And then when the brain is twisted, when those stresses are there, then the way I see my world is twisted. So the lovely thing, this is why in many ways, and therapy is valuable, but TM is incredibly valuable, often in concert, is it allows the body to take this state of rest deeper than sleep, and those knots of stress are unstressed, unwound.
Right.
And then you're like free to think more clearly, and you're free to look carefully at, oh, my behavior, I keep reacting in the same kind of worn-out way. I don't think I want to do that anymore. Whereas if you're just in a lockdown mode, you never even come to that realization. You know
so
what I mean?
We talked a little bit about that, you know, teaching at-risk youth meditation, but why that's important, what the effect, what are the effects is that that has on kids. So people go, well, what's the big deal? You teach them how to meditate a little bit, but the statistics are astounding.
So I want to go back just for a moment and sure. revisit what we were talking about
yeah.
this helps at-risk kids, something I wanted to tell you. So 2 years ago, the University of Chicago, they have a crime and education lab, which is one of the premier research institutions in the country for ways to reduce crime among youth in particular. And one of the things they look to do is to reduce arrests for violent crime among urban youth in the summer months. That's when they're out of school, because if a kid gets arrested, then they're in the school-to-prison pipeline. It destroys their lives. It destroys family lives. It destroys the whole community. So 2 years ago, the University of Chicago put out a request for any organization in Chicago if they had an answer, something to do to reduce violent crime. 230 organizations submitted proposals. They selected three. David Lynch Foundation was one of three. The first year they gave us $300,000 to do a pilot study. Most of the money goes for the research. The results were so good, last year they increased it to, they gave an additional $1 million. And the results were so significant, this year they increased it to $1.6 million to study 2,000 kids. Not only did they find grades went up, graduation rates went up, suspensions and expulsions went down, but really significantly, if they do an intervention to reduce arrests for violent crime in the summer among this population of teens, and they reduces it 5%, they consider it successful. The meditating teens, that means they meditated during the summer when school was not in session, there was an 84% reduction in arrests for violent crime.
And what do they attribute that to?
Reduced stress, calming the amygdala, waking up the prefrontal cortex, making better decisions, not being so reactive, first of all, most of those kids, when they do something violent, they're often on drugs. And why are they on drugs? They're self-medicating themselves from the trauma and the tension and the stress of their lives. So if you give them a tool that calms the amygdala, which is the fight or flight, reduces the cortisol, wakes up the executive functioning in the brain, they're more self-sufficient, they're more self-referral. They don't go along with the crowd. They're happier themselves. So they don't take drugs and they don't get in harm's way. Those findings were so significant that the federal government gave several hundred thousand dollars to the crime lab to teach more kids to meditate. And now what we're doing in New York City is we're about to replicate that study with 4,000 kids in public schools in New York. And if we find the same results, it could well mean that these are Title I funds. Title I means schools below the poverty level. And there's millions of kids that way, that transcendental meditation could be available for free to every child in these schools. It will change. It will save a generation.
Where should people go to the David Lynch Foundation?
I think what they can do is there are two different things. They can go to the DavidLynchFoundation.org, DavidLynchFoundation.org. They can go to TM.org, or I'm going to do something here, which is... He'll kill me. I'm going to give you my email address.
What?
My real email address.
You're giving out your real...
I am. And you can email me, and I will put you in touch with... What you have to do is tell me where you live. Don't say, I really want to learn to meditate. Say, I live in this town. I really would like to meditate. And I'll put you in the direction of a teacher.
That's very nice of you.
And the email address is bob@davidlynchfoundation.org. I trust you. Bob@davidlynchfoundation.org.
How did you come up with that email address?
It's almost like default mode network.
Yes,
I mean, it's like
exactly.
As creative as that was.
A panel of people.
That's right. We think, all right, what does the brain do when it defaults default mode network? Okay.
As Bob at the David Lynch Foundation, what is it that you're joyful about in the world? I mean, obviously, I know you're passionate about TM. I know you're passionate about bringing TM to children and people who are at risk. But what about you personally? Like, what's something that you like? What do you like It could be like, oh, I like a hot dog at this one place, or I like a thing. It could
okay,
be
okay,
anything.
I'm going to tell you. This is going to be strange. I've discovered on Amazon Prime documentaries of the Hubble telescope.
Wow! Multiple documentaries.
Mind-blowing. The universe. I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting older. It's like I have a moment to sort of observe. It's like think about it. Trillions of miles and growing across. There's in our galaxy. It's just like I just think it's just it helps me because when I'm watching the news and I think this is insane and what's going on, and then I watch this and go, Earth has been here for 4 billion years, you know. But here's the thing, here's the deal. In our galaxy, which is a small galaxy, there are 100 billion stars the size of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
There are in the universe. There are several 100 billion galaxies.
Right.
That's big.
That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff out there.
That is a lot of stuff.
And I love nature. So I love seeing the intelligence of nature. So then I start watching. Is this like totally boring?
No.
I love watching sort of like you look at what like a gnat. You know, these huge telescopes, microscopes where you can see the sophistication of that little head on a gnat or this bug, and I just think nature, geez Louise, like beyond.
What a showboat nature! I get
it. It's just like so that. I mean, that's what else do I like to do?
But let me ask you about this. Do you ever think about the? Oh, this just sounds like we're in. I don't want to sound like a seventh grader who just smoked pot for the first time. But you think about the expanse of the universe, and then you think about what happens when you quiet your mind and the sort of universe that opens up.
And according to the... This is such great questions.
Well, thanks.
Honest. The ancient texts say that the deepest level of human nature and the deepest level of nature's nature are the same. So you can access that unified field. This is the theory. What physics calls a unified field from where all these galaxies emerge. And the deepest level of your own nature, that unbounded awareness, is the same. And that you actually can access. It's like the seed for... You see a redwood tree that's like 2,000 years old.
Yeah.
All emerges from that same little seed. So you can access that field from within yourself. And that is human potential. To express, to create the same creative intelligence that you see in nature within yourself. So... It's a theory. It's interesting, but I like it.
Yeah. I mean, just the connection point of just thinking how
that
expansive everything is, and then thinking about how boundless the mind feels when you can get down into that.
Yes.
That it's just this like near infinite well.
And you are accessing that, and then your life is fluid and simple and elegant and powerful and fulfilling, and you're able to give maximum back to the world, and you're just in tune. We can conclude with, I'll tell you two stories from Marshy, which I talk about in a book. So a reporter was asking Maharishi, he said, you like oversell TM. You like dial it back a little bit. You know, there's been violence and stress and, you know, suffering in the world since times immemorial. You know, little much. And you say that TM, transcending, forget TM, is like that accessing that silence within can transform lives. And he said, and that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. So he said, you can have a room that's been dark for one night, and you can have a room that's been dark for 1,000 years. And you turn on a flashlight in both rooms, and the darkness disappears. It doesn't take 3 seconds longer for that other room. So in that, his perspective is, human beings have not been accessing that inner birthright, that we are part of nature. We have access to that same creative intelligence, which is displayed in the universe. If you're not using that, life is hell. and look around. But if you access that, life lights up. Life is in enlightenment. So the last thing is, so I think that was a lovely sort of...
And also it sort of gives you a sense that to be a wise man, you have to answer questions to snarky people.
Yeah.
You have to give great answers. Because it's always, well, someone asked this person, they're like, oh, that was the perfect answer for that. And then that's a
person.
So
the same reporter said at the end, he said, well, why is there so much suffering in the world? And Maharishi said, because everything is as it should be. And then the reporter said, well, then why are you working so hard to change things? And Maharishi said, because everything is as it should be.
Oh, and did that reporter shut up after that?
Yeah, because the reporter started meditating.
Oh, that's great.
I taught the reporter to meditate.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Does he still meditate?
Yeah. He's the AP reporter from Amsterdam.
Oh, that's fantastic. I can't thank you enough for letting me come to your office, giving out your email, giving us...
Bob@davidlynchfoundation.org.
More than enough science alerts, and a science alert that I feel like you should be implementing into your own Success Without Stress, which is on... What channel is that on Sirius?
121 now, I think. It's on Indie Channel 121.
Gotcha.
They moved it. Yeah, it's 121.
Did.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And is there a website for that as well? Or is...
No, but I don't think so. But it's bob@davidlynchfoundation.org. You can go to davidlynchfoundation.org to see the work we're doing, tm.org for just more information about TM. But write me and I'll point you in the right direction.
And I think Success Without Stress could be in a book.
Yeah.
Because I think those words together, no one teaches you, like, we always prepare people for failure, but we never prepare people for success. And they can both be equally stressful.
Yeah.
And so I think...
That's beautiful. Jesus.
So I think...
Jesus.
So I think, you know, teaching people that... And also defining what success is.
Yeah.
What's your metric for success and what does it mean to you? And then once that you sort of have that in place, how you process it
and
deal with it.
Again, that same reporter, funnily enough, you asked this. So a reporter asked Maharishi, what's your measure of success? And he said 200% of life. 100% outer, comfort, progress, and 100% inner, silent consciousness, development of consciousness. One without the other is not successful life.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being in your own office.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for coming. And no more science alerts.
Science alert! Enjoy your burrito.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.